This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Covered in Pet Hair, a boozy show for pet lovers on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Isabel Alvarez-Arada, and today I have the pleasure of having a drink and a chat with an author that has a very relatable story to tell. I will tell you all about her and introduce you as soon as we come back from these messages from our sponsors. Hi, I'm Isabel Alvarez-Arada, the host of Covered in Pet Hair. You know the expression, cats have nine lives? Well, what if you could give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying and neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Covered in Pet Hair. I'm your host, Isabel Alvarez-Arada, and today I have the pleasure of having a drink and a chat with a pet parent, a published author. She's an adventure seeker, a world traveler, a fitness fanatic, and a Tai Chi student. She's a theater lover, a storyteller. She's originally from the Boston area, lived in Philadelphia for 35 years, and moved back to Midtown Manhattan in 2018. She's wife to husband of 46 years. His name is Andy. And she's dog mom to two Bichon rescues. They're 14 years old, Megan and Chase. She is the author of a memoir titled Maddie, Milo, and Me, which was published in April by She Writes Press. She is Ann Abel, and she is here to tell her story about Maddie and Milo and all that came with those two adventurous pet parenting experiences. Welcome, Ann. It's so good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here.
Well, I am thrilled to have you here. I have been listening to some podcasts that you've already done as part of my research, and I find your story so relatable in so many ways. I know that my audience is going to enjoy this as much as I am. I hope you enjoy this too. Before we dig into all of that, I want to introduce our drinking game today for our audience. So anybody at home participating in our drinking game today, anytime you hear this word.
The secret word is reluctant.
Take a drink of whatever you're enjoying. Please be over 21 to partake in an alcoholic beverage in the U.S. Never drink and drive and always drink responsibly. So I know you've had a pretty rough week, my friend. So what are you joining us with today?
Well, I'm pretty consistent. It's my Essentia overachieving water because I need all the help I can get achieving. So I drink overachieving water.
Speaking of overachieving, I hear you have a second book coming out in 2025. So I think you're doing just fine. Is it the water or is it just who you are?
Probably a combination of both. I take help wherever I can get it.
I love that. Well, I take help wherever I can get it too. I'm having a white wine today from my membership to nakedwines.com. I have never heard of this wine. I don't even know what grape it is. It's an Italian grape. And cheers. I just want to enjoy this Friday evening, getting to know you. So here, cheers. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. Can I drink from my water?
I'm so happy you're on the show today. I want to get to know more about your writing experience as well as your pet parenting experience. And I want to do that by playing a first game with you called Memoir Memories about the process of writing your memoir. So this is a quick fire game. So keep your answers as short as possible. We're going to dig in a little bit further once I ask you some specific questions. But are you ready to play?
I'm ready.
I know. So anybody who's not sure, I do not share any of my questions or games beforehand. So my guess when they say, I'm ready, it's because they have no idea what to expect. And that's the way I like it.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. The first question is, when did you get the itch to write a memoir?
I know exactly when it was. It was 2018, probably April 2017. This isn't prepared. So 2018 in April.
Okay. And what is it? What was it that made you want to write a memoir versus a novel or nonfiction of other sorts?
Well, I was always a memoir person. I don't write fiction. I have a long answer. Actually, we moved to Chicago in 2016 for my husband to visit the University of Chicago from Philadelphia. And I got kicked out of improv I had 8 degrees there in January. So I signed up for improv in Chicago. I flailed and failed and pretty quickly got kicked out. I came home. It was February. I had no one. My new dog walker came in. I said, "What are you doing? You're not walking dogs." And she said, "I host a storytelling open mic." I had never heard of storytelling before. Eventually I went, I listened, but I actually got up because there were three men who got up who were just really horrible. And I never say this, but I said to my husband, "I can do better than that." I'd never stood in front of a mic, and I got up and I spoke for 4 minutes. People were cheering. And then I started doing open mics and people were coming up and they loved my stories. And then I started getting invited to curated shows. And I'd always had writer's block. I was a freelance writer and I could write if an editor said, "Go write about that tree in your backyard," however many words he wanted, I could do it. But if I sat down and wanted to write about me, it's like, so what, who cares? And I was under the desk. But here I had people coming up to me afterwards saying, oh, will you be in my show? Oh, that's so interesting. So that gave me encouragement. And then someone said, "You've got to go to The Moth," which I had never heard of The Moth. And I won a few story slams, but then I wanted to get better. So I contacted this woman, a storytelling coach, and I was over the phone. And the first thing she said to me was, "If I could wave a magic wand and grant you any wish, what would it be?" I thought she was going to ask me my storytelling hopes and dreams. And I said, "To write a book." I don't even know where that came out of. And she said, "Well, then that's what you've got to do." And I knew she was right. And that was April, May, June. 3 months, I didn't do it. I kept getting angrier and angrier and angrier at myself because I just couldn't do it. And then I work out every day. Nothing stops me. And I don't question it. You know, the Nike, "Just do it." I love that because you just do it. And then you get off and you feel great. So one day in July, after 3 months, it was getting worse. I was feeling worse and worse. And I said, "Okay, after you work out, you're just going to go sit at your desk for 2 hours. That's it." And I had this story about a trip I had taken to Australia to follow Bruce Springsteen when I quit my job at the community college. And I suffered with depression and I was terrified about being in this empty house with no structure. And I hate to travel. I hate to be alone. I hadn't known what a Bruce Springsteen was a year earlier. I had never been to a concert. And I went home and had heard somewhere that he would be traveling in Australia in February. This was October. I went home. Within a week, that trip was booked. And I was going to Australia for 26 days to see 8 concerts in 5 different cities. I was terrified. But I didn't go to change. I just went because I've had ECT 3 times. I was inpatient twice and I was 60 years old. I wasn't doing those things. I had to come up with a creative solution on my own. And that's what I did. I didn't go to change, but I came home with this ball of energy inside me that I had never had before. And I was determined not to lose it. And I came back to Philadelphia. I got rid of all my friends in Philadelphia because they weren't really friends. In Australia, strangers had come up and said things to me and I would step outside myself and look at myself through their eyes. And home, people were rolling their eyes like, "Oh, it must be nice to be able to be a Bruce Springsteen roadie." You know, I was really fighting for my life. Whereas in Australia, this one young man said, "My mother just retired. We can't get her off the couch to go to a movie and look at you." You know, people, it was lonely. It was hard, but it was also really exhilarating. So I knew this was a story and that's what I wanted to write about. So that first day I went up to my desk And for 2 hours I wrote, and my husband was my muse because I needed to have someone who I thought would be interested. And every day I'd show it to him. He's not a writer or anything. He'd go, oh, that's good, that's good. And anything that came into my head that might remotely be connected, I wrote it, because if I started saying, no, that doesn't belong, I would end up not writing anything.
Right.
So the first draft was 1,000 pages. And the final 10th draft, the final draft is 400 pages. But that first draft had everything pretty much that had ever happened to me in my life up until that point. So that's how. And then what happened was, it was during the lockdown. I was working on this and I sent it to my editor and she was working on it. It was taking her forever. We were stuck in the house.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine kept saying, you should write about Milo. You should write about Milo. You should write about Milo. So I sat down and wrote the Milo story. And then that was a much more straightforward story. So I decided to concentrate on that one and get that out into the world and then go back to the other one. So that's how these two books came to be. And it's all because this woman said, I'll wave a magic wand.
Wow. Well, I totally agree with you about writing. I write for magazines too. I'm a journalist. And whenever I'm assigned something, I can write about it. But writing my own story definitely is hard. I haven't even started. But I too have a dream of writing something, sharing it with the world in a book format. So we shall see. I will get my inspiration from you, who now, from not knowing where to start, now having two books, one in 2024, one in 2025. Is the 2025 book the one that about Australia?
Yes, fall 2025. It's about.
And what's the title?
Well, right now it's alive, but I don't know. And I'm trying to imagine what the covers are going to be. I mean, with
these so cool. That's such a cool process. Okay, so how long does it take you to write a book, more or less?
Oh, well, again, I started the Australia story July 2018, and it was accepted last year, so 2023. But, it really varies. It really varies. And
yeah, everybody's process is different. That's why I ask these questions, because there's people who are like, oh, I locked myself in a hotel room and wrote for 2 months, and right. I had to get it done, and they do it.
Right.
And then there are people who take way longer. It just start and then ignore it for 4 years and then write it all in one sitting.
I remember Bruce Springsteen wrote a memoir, and I think he sat down and did it in like 3 months or something.
Yes, exactly. Like, there are people who do it that way. Most people do it a lot less of a straight line, for sure. Did it evolve from what you originally planned? Just the Milo story. Did it evolve? Because you wanted to tell just the story of Milo, but your book really turned out to be about more than just that naughty dog.
Right. Well, it's not just about dogs. It's about life. Milo didn't exist in a vacuum. Maddie didn't. And, so it's about the forces that I tried to show why I did what I did. And it's about digging. When you write something like that, and one of my, the editors, that's their job, I guess, you need to dig deeper. Like, it's in your head. So you assume everyone knows, but people don't know. So there were instances where I had to just go back and, like, as you say, unpack the whole thing.
Yes. And how do you feel about sharing it now that it's out in the public and that big part of you is out for everybody to see?
I'm a pretty open person, so I just hope people will like it and people can get something out of it. There's a lot of lessons in watching someone else's life or seeing how someone else copes with things. It helps if you're in a similar situation. It gives you an idea of a possibility of how to deal with things.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I love about your story in general, is that it's so relatable. And I think that you go deep in that you do highlight the ways that our pets don't exist in a vacuum, how they impact our every part of our lives and our growth, personal growth as well. So last question for this game is, if there was one story in the book, the Milo book specifically, is there one story that is like your favorite, that if you had to read it at like a book tour, that's the story you would read?
Well, there's a few. I mean, there's one, but it's not earth shattering, but it's one of my favorite moments. And that's when, so Milo was really aggressive, out of control, and alpha. I'm a beta. I'm just not like that at all. And the teacher kept yelling at me. She, you know, once she said something, I said, well, you're the boss. She goes, no, Ann, you're the boss. But, you know, so it was really hard. That was just beaten out of me in childhood. But I have this crazy out of control dog who bit my kids. And she says to me, you need, and he's just, everything triggers him. Leaves, rustling, everything. She said, you have to take him into a crowded place and you have to start desensitizing him to these triggers. I'm like, okay, yeah, right. And she was very authoritarian and I'm kind of intimidated by those people. But I said, and with sarcasm, I'm like, okay. So, but then I backed off. I figured, I knew she was on my team. So one day I'm out there walking him and we end up, it was 10 degrees out. It was two. So fortunately there were no people out. So I knew it'd be safe. And we end up near this Bed Bath & Beyond near our house. And there was a lobby on the first floor and elevators up. And we go in there. Really, it was 10 degrees out. And wouldn't you know it, it was January. They had a picnic table and chair. They were already getting ready for spring. So I sit down. I take off my coat. And I sit in the chair at the picnic table. I put Milo beside me. And I decide we're going to desensitize him so we won't want to attack people. And I had morsels of chicken in my pocket, and we're sitting there, and there was an escalator that went up to the store and down to the store. So we're sitting there, and I'm shoveling these chicken bits in his mouth, and I see this older woman coming down the stairs, and then her bag rustled, and I knew him. I'd had him about a month now, maybe 6 weeks, and I knew him so well. You know, I just every muscle, I knew what that meant. And I'm like, and he heard the bag, and he was like, he went on alert, and I'm shoving. Milo, you don't want to eat this lady. You don't want to eat this lady. And then she's walking along. She's putting her gloves on. And I mean, you know, was it reckless of me? Yes, it was reckless probably. But I like to say, as I said in the book, that when you're a surgeon, you have to start on someone. So, you know, someone has to be first. But, and I'm just shoveling. And as I'm shoveling, he starts to calm down. And she just walks along past us, oblivious to this intense picnic that was taking place right by there. And then a few minutes later, this young college student came down and Milo got tense. And then he stops and he's like, well, what kind of dog is that? And he starts making, you know, and I'm shoveling the treats and I'm thinking, we're not here to learn how to make small talk. But
yeah,
how he was very nice. And he's like, oh, you're a lucky dog. And after he left, I turned to Milo. I said, he was a nice boy, wasn't he, Milo? And it was just, I suffer with depression and it was late afternoon and that's usually when I feel my lowest. But there I was sitting in a lobby of a Bed Bath & Beyond in January at a picnic table feeling good, you know, and it was a nice
feeling like you were, that was a really big win.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It was the beginning. It was probably the beginning of his progress.
Okay. So you mentioned leaving your job at the community college. Were you involved in education prior to becoming a writer, roadie,
yeah,
whatever you want to describe yourself as?
Toward the end of Milo's life, I started teaching at the community college, English at the Community College of Philadelphia. And I did that for 5 years. And I loved it. I loved it. But I had this one class and they were literally throwing desks. And I'm not easily scared, but one day they were plotting against me out in the hall. And you know what? I walked out. It was a beautiful October afternoon. You know, the sun. I just thought, you know what? I don't need this. There was no support. There was no support. You know, I went and talked to the head of the department. And he said, well, that's why we have these beige phones in the room if you're worried. So I went that day. I picked up the phone and it didn't work. So,
oh my goodness.
That was great.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so before Milo, you actually had your other dog who was, from my understanding, a perfect dog. She was perfect.
Absolutely. All she wanted to do was give love and take love. She even taught us this game called Family Hug. I don't know how she taught it to us, but we'd go in. Somehow she'd corral us and we'd go in our hall and she'd start. It was sort of like duck, duck, goose, only no one was ever out. She'd like start running around and we'd all scream, family hug. And then she'd stop next to us and we would hug her. And it was a really lovely game.
Did you rescue Maddie or she was a Wheaton Terrier?
Yes.
How did you get her?
Well, my middle son had wanted a dog pretty much from the day he was born. And I really didn't want a dog. I can't tell. I mean, I just did. So we got him every kind of caged or tanked animal. And then for his 10th birthday in January, right before, I saw a headline, African hedgehog, the perfect pet. So I called the store to get, and I said, how about that? And he wanted a dog, but if he couldn't get a dog. So I called the pet store and he said, well, ma'am, you know, you have to wear rubber gloves to hand. They're really porcupines.
Yeah.
And I just realized it was, sadly, my heart sank. It was time for the dog. And I'm not a shopper. And I go need an appliance. When we moved from Boston to Philadelphia, I looked at 3 houses and bought one. If I need an appliance, I get one. It's good enough. But good enough wasn't going to cut it with the dog. So I got a book, almost 500 breeds. And then one day, one of my other sons came home from a teammate's house excited about a Wheaton Terrier. Uh-huh. I looked it up, did everything but empty the dishwasher, called the breeder. Again, in January, he said, fine, we'll put you on our list for May. And I hung up the phone. I thought, sometimes it's just so easy to be a good mother. It was, you know, anything can happen between January and May. And then 5 days later, she calls me and she says, well, we have this 10-month-old dog named Maddie. We're going to use her as a show dog, but her neck's too short. You can come out this weekend. And if everything... And I could have said, no, we want a puppy. I didn't have to tell my kids that she called, but I'm not like that. So with a heavy heart, I said, okay, we'll be there. And they all got in the car on Sunday and I just walked through my house looking at it. It's never going to look like this again. And again, my depression I was mired on that 50-60 minute ride to the breeder's house. I didn't hear anything that went on in the car. The kids checked out. They said, go in the kitchen. We'll send Maddie up. And I'm just standing there like, you know, this is kind of the end of my life. A comatose. All of a sudden, this white ball of fluff comes swirling into the room, runs around and lands at my feet. I collapse my feet, hug her, and I was in love. And I was in love. That was it.
That is wonderful. And I know that you had how many years with Maddie?
7.
7 before you had a very traumatic experience losing her. She was hurt by a delivery truck.
Yeah. 10 days before Christmas.
Oh my goodness. I can't imagine the trauma that one would have after watching that happen.
I didn't see it happen.
Thank goodness. But yeah. Still knowing that that happened and having to, you know, say goodbye so much sooner than I'm sure you expected to, right? We always think, hopefully they'll live 12 years, yeah. 13, maybe even 15.
Right.
But 7 is just not, you're not prepared for that. So I can only imagine how traumatic that was for you, for your spouse, for your children. And I did read that you basically waited about 24 hours before you got another dog. Tell me about that. From being so reluctant to have a dog in the first place to fast tracking Milo's arrival. Tell me about that.
Well, I saw the error of my ways. I love Maddie. I was now a dog person. And I mean, I worked at home. She sat by my desk and we would go out, have a snack. I mean, we spent a lot of time together and I still get the chills remembering that to be there day after day, the void would just be horrible. So, and this is just how and this might not be funny to some people, but again, my husband and I have been married 46 years and we joke that I should be so lucky the day after I hope I go first, but if I don't, I want to get married. I like being married. I don't like being alone. I like being with people that I love.
Yes.
And I needed at least a distraction from this void, the void left by Maddie. And now my kids and we were, I was a little worried that the kids might, and they were, my younger kids were 13 and 17. So they weren't really young babies, but before we made the commitment to go to the rescue, we called my therapist because I was worried that I didn't want them to think people or living beings were just replaceable.
Right.
And we talked about it and she said that they were old enough that we were always doing for them and they were old enough to consider the situation and understand me and my depression and how important this was for my mental health and to be able to do something for me. And we went to school. We told them we had an appointment at the rescue. And they both said, you know, we're not ready. We need to mourn and grieve Maddie. But we understand. We understand. And we all went together. And actually, one thing I said that I thought was, I said, if we took a rescue home, then at least one living being in the universe would be better off of this horrible thing for Maddie's being killed. There was just no, you know, there was nothing positive about it. But if we brought home a rescue, someone would be better off. And then when we got there, I had told the man I wanted a small lap dog who didn't shed. And we get there and he's out in the meadow waiting for us with this beautiful dog. And we just fell in love with him immediately. But then I said, well, wait a minute. I told you I want a small lap dog. So he goes, okay, come in the waiting room. I'll put Milo back and I'll send out and bring out another dog. And then, so Milo, we meet in a meadow. You know, he's just lying sitting there. So in this little cramped waiting room at like 6 o'clock on a cold December night, and he unleashes this little Bichon named Scooter, who is very aptly named because he's ricocheting off the walls of my 13-year-old son, who didn't want to get another dog right away. The one in the family with the least work, says the least. He goes, take Scooter back. We want Milo. And then the man, I mean, he's a very good salesman. It was right after 9/11. It was December of 2001. And he said, well, let me take you to the kennels. Maybe you have friends who need dogs. We have a lot of 9/11 dogs. And all the dogs are at the cage barking and going nuts. And then Milo's just curled up in a ball on a bed of rags. And we stop and we look at him. And here's this animal we had bonded with an hour earlier out in the meadow. And he's just, and then when we got back, my son said, okay, we can take Milo home. I mean, you know, it was very well orchestrated.
Well, I did hear that you suspect that maybe Milo was under an influence of some kind of calming.
Okay, I don't know how rescues work, and we never, you know, it wasn't really important to us, but it was night and day.
Yeah.
We get it, and the next day he comes home, and he was a wild animal, biting, humping. I mean, we called him Mellow Milo in the meadow. So I don't know what they do in
They don't do that. And really, there's no way to know, right? Like I heard you say, there was no way to say that. It was just kind of like, it was a possibility just because of the difference. Exactly.
It's what my son said as I was bandaging his hand one day, but
yeah, it could be true. It absolutely could be true.
We were the third family in 18 months. And when we went for our interview at the dog school, and the woman said, she told us, you know, you're the third family in 18 months. He should never have given, he knew you were vulnerable. He should never have given you Milo. You should take him back. And at that point, he was just sitting perfectly next to my husband. I said, but look at him. He's being so good. That that's because he's internally stressing. He knows what we're talking about. Like, I didn't come here for a sentence for my, you know,
yes,
I came here for help. And then we left, and my kids, and it's so sweet. They hadn't wanted to get another dog. And here there's this dog like completely terrorizing everyone, but they became so defensive of him. And when we got outside, they're like, because I had told her all the problems. They said, why did you tell her all those things? You know, they were very defensive of Milo's. And that was one thing. And they never once said to me, see, you should never have rushed out to get another dog. I mean, everyone was supportive.
Right. Well, I'm a big believer that we get the dog that we're supposed to get or the pet that we're supposed to get. And that sometimes they need us more than we need them. So it sounds like maybe Maddie, you needed her.
Okay.
And Milo, he needed you. And sometimes that's just how it works. And we're kind of used to that relationship where they support us and they give us all this love. And then the next pet that comes into our life is a total change. It's they need us and they need our support.
I do think I got a lot out of I think it actually, at one point I said, I helped Milo, Milo helped me. It was simple. It was complicated. It was love. I mean,
exactly.
It was a different love. It was a whole different relationship than with Maddie. That's another theme in my book, actually, that I feel strongly about this with people and all living beings, individuality. Yes. My parents just squashed any individuality. And when my kids were born, I was determined to nurture whatever sparks they found. And then with, you know, Maddie was a certain kind of dog and I nurtured that. And then Milo, you know, once we started working with him, he had a joie de vivre, he was adventurous, athletic. You know, and I really, I took a lot of pleasure in letting him, even though, you know, I ended up going in the woods, which I hated. But when I'd see him come soaring by me, being this animal that he was meant to be, I had heard in meditation class about sympathetic empathy.
Yes. Sympathy versus empathy. Yes.
Yeah. And just seeing, there I was in the woods, which I hated, trudging along, but I did it every day for an hour. I hated every minute. But then all of a sudden, I would see him just being Milo. And I would, to this day, I get chills when I remember those moments. So I found joy in unexpected places.
Absolutely. And I want to get to know Milo and what made him such a naughty dog. But we'll take a break right here. And when we come back, I've got a game to play where you're going to tell us all the things that Milo did to get him rehomed 3 times in 18 months. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back with Ann Abel, author and dog lover.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Covered in Pet Hair. I'm your host, Isabel Alvarez-Arada, and today I'm having a fabulous conversation with Ann Abel, who is the author behind the newest memoir called Maddie, Milo, and Me. And she is here to share her story, but not only share the fact that she wrote a book and how that book came to be, but also the story of a very unexpected dog that came into her life under duress in many ways, and all the things that he taught her while also making you crazy a little bit, right? And he made you a little nutty, I feel like.
Oh, it was terrifying. I was what was standing between the world. I mean, he could attack anyone or anything. It wasn't going to be good for him. It wouldn't be good for the person on the other side of him. I mean, I was what was standing between him and a life in a rescue. And I yes. I knew nothing about dogs. I really had no interest in training dogs, but and if I had known, you know, I made the commitment right away. I just couldn't send him back. If I don't know, I would have done the same thing if I had known what was ahead for me, but I'm glad I didn't know, because it was a commitment to his whole life. Every day
Absolutely.
For 2 years, I was in the woods, which I said, I don't like woods, but I did it. I did it for Milo because it was really good for him and he loved it.
Yes. I think the people who are going to relate to this the most are people who've had a heathen dog, like one of these dogs that are just completely out of control, that are not other dog friendly, that are potentially not human friendly. And unless you've lived that life, and I have, maybe not to the extent that you experience, because it sounds like Sox maybe was more afraid of strangers than just anybody. It sounds like Milo was aggressive in many cases toward whomever. But I had a dog that literally, like, most people would have taken her back. Like you said, most people would have said, like, this is not going to work. I can't do this. And luckily, she found her way. Her name was Sox. She found her way to me and my family and me at that time in my life where I was able to commit to helping her. And she lived with me for 12 years, almost exactly. And that was really, really hard, but it was worth it because I learned so much. And I think that she prepared me for parenting humans. I actually had my dogs before I had my kids. And let me tell you, that is a boot camp of how to work with another creature, a wild animal, like you said. So I want to get to know just how wild Milo was. I have a game called Milo Mayhem, and I'm going to give you 2 minutes on my handy dandy clock here just to give us some examples of things that Milo did off the top of your head. Just ready? Like, I mean, just let it go.
Okay, well, first of all, anyone who came into our house, he humped and jumped, he barked, he howled, he prowled. But, for, you know, the rescue man, when he dropped in our house, said you should take him for a walk. So it's December, it's cold. I didn't want a dog way back because I hate walking dogs. We didn't have to walk Maddie. So we go out, any squirrel, any leaf. I mean, he literally was pulling me on my belly on the cold, wet leaves after what anything that moved. And then finally, a few days later, I got him up 0.4 miles. There was a sidewalk, and we're there, and that was going to be better. And then all of a sudden, I'm flying. I'm on my stomach in front of, and I look up, and I was due for rotator cuff surgery. And a school bus, I'm on my belly on the road, and a school bus comes screeching to a halt an arm's length away from me. And I'm lying there on the ground, and then I make sure nothing's broken. I stand up, I get whole mile over to the side of the road. I also hate being the center of attention, and there's all this traffic is now backed up, and every, you know, rush hour traffic, they're all staring at me. So when everybody had gone and it was like new people, I just turned to Milo and I just screamed, I hate you so much, I hate you, and I'm taking you back. And then I looked at him and I just resigned myself to what I thought would be 15 years of servitude. But he was just out of control. He was, after our dog school interview where we got rejected, we took him to an acquaintance's house who's a dog whisperer. She has 5 rescues. And she made my husband and me leave, and she took him with the kids. And we came back and she had him doing all these tricks. And she said, look, I don't know that. She said, I don't know that he isn't salvageable. He's an out of control, high energy dog. And, you know, for all I know, maybe he had a bit of wolf in him. You know, I was told no amount of training will ever make Milo perfect. And until a week before he died, he bit my husband on the wrist because some pea soup fell out of the refrigerator. My husband reached for it. And my husband said, it's my fault. The rule is if it hits the ground, it's Milo.
It's Milo's.
People would see us with these bandages and they'd say, you have to get rid of that animal. And when he's not an animal, he's part of our family. But he had this little, so we did a lot of behavior, you know, and we had routines. But, and there's an episode in my book where I talk about when he bit me, you know, he actually bit me twice. He lunged at me twice because I was too lazy and too rushed to go through the routine. I gave him a bone to, but I didn't do the usual things to remind him that I was the alpha. And then I bent over to tie my shoe and something just clicked, you know, he just kind of lost it and he went after me. So, but, you know, we settled into a routine and we may believe I was the alpha. We both knew I wasn't the alpha, but I did for him. And he usually did for me so that we could have oh my God, I love that dog. I loved him.
Oh my goodness. Well, that was 3 minutes and 20 seconds.
Sorry.
So you're fine. You're fine.
I was expecting you to stop me.
No, nobody ever finishes and I never stop you. So don't worry about that. So describe Milo physically. Was he a bigger dog? As you did mention that you wanted a little lap dog.
To me, big, you know, 60, 65 pounds.
Wow, that is big.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wanted a small lap dog.
Yes.
But he was beautiful and he really was so curious. And again, I suffer with depression. So it was, and he was just curious about everything, whether it was the bees in the backyard or a spider that went under the bed. He just had such energy, and I'm remembering it, it would just be kind of, it was really fun, and I don't use that word often, to watch him, like, go after, like, stalk the bees or stalk the spider or just be so excited about being in the woods, about everything, you know, just, he was just this real joie de vivre, and it was really good for me to be exposed to that.
Yeah, totally different experience. So when did you realize that you had gone kind of looking to fill the void that Maddie left and you had filled it with this mayhem? When did that, you realize that? Was that instant?
Right away. Yeah. I mean, right away. And then that's another theme in this book is that I was brought up being told I was a burden not to ask for anything, including help. But with Milo, and then at one point, halfway through our first class, kindergarten class, I needed rotator cuff surgery. And I told the teacher and she's like, no, you have to postpone the surgery. You know, I'd signed up 6 months earlier or whatever. And she's, Milo's gifted. And I laughed because my kids were really bright, but no one ever called them gifted. And she said, I said, well, we'll take the class next next time. She goes, no, Milo will be bored. Anyhow, the jungle drums that the dog community beat. And before you knew it, they were offering to help this friend acquaintance would take Milo and to class. And at first I was really uncomfortable accepting this help, but then I knew it was good for Milo. And so through Milo, I learned that it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to accept help. So that was a big lesson for me.
Yes, absolutely.
I could never, and you know, when you get an animal like this, you need to get asked for expert help. I could, you know, that was really, I just put my trust in this teacher. And like when she said, go out and de-trigger him, I just really had faith. And she was on my team. You know, she was on our team.
That is really important. I do think that that's really important. Before I started my work as a writer, I actually ran a pet sitting dog walking business. And we definitely had dogs that were challenges, you know, and we considered ourselves part of that team. And when it was too big for a professional dog walker or pet sitter, we always said, like, we cannot continue being on your team unless you go to somebody who's going to help you modify this behavior. And I do think that people think it's too expensive. They think that it's, you know, too much work. But if you're going to commit to a special dog that has high energy, reactive, has, you know, minimal idea of what boundaries are, etc., then you have to put in that work and you have to make that investment. And I'm so impressed that you went from having like this perfect dog to getting this dog that was a challenge. And you knew immediately, like, I need help. Because a lot of people might have been like, you know, he'll eventually get there. Maddie was perfect. He'll get there. But you were really proactive. Is that just who you are?
Oh, I am very proactive. But the guy, the rescue guy, when he dropped Milo off, he said, oh, Milo would benefit from dog school. So right away I called, it was called What a Good Dog! Exclamation point. And we signed up and she said, well, you have to come for your interview in a week. And we went, that's when the woman said, you've got to give him back. And then we went to our acquaintance who had given me the name of the rescue, who had put me in touch. And she's the one who said, I'm not sure he isn't salvageable. But then what she did was, she never admitted this. She called the owner of the school, Mary, because she had said it's too bad Mary can't come see him, but she only sees exceptional dogs, the show dogs. And then we got home that night and there was a message, Mary will be at your house. Mary Rima will be at your house tomorrow at 5:00. This was New Year's Eve. I wish she was going to be there. So someone called her and said, whatever kind of exceptional Milo. And she wasn't a trainer. She owned this dog school. And so I showed up to class and we were in a separate room from everybody else. But she told me what every week she said, you know, I had homework every week and I just did what. So it was a lot of work. I mean, there was a lot of work up front for that. For the first 6 months, it was because you have to, you know, you have to establish who's the alpha. I think when I was in the midst of it, I didn't really think about it. But thinking back on it, I mean, it was all consuming.
If I had a mom though, so you were a mom already, so you knew what that was.
Okay, that's. I'm glad you brought that up. I had three of the my boys were so easy. They were just a joy. They were really like, they were high achieving, nice, friendly. And all of a sudden, I was the mom of the bad boy at school. I would go to school. And the mothers would pull, you know, every now and then Mary would say, come into the room. And she had a woman with a spray bottle mixture of water and vinegar with,
my Lord.
And everybody, we'd come in and they'd pull back, you know, like we were just, I was shunned. And I was not used to being the mother of the, but I had to get used to it because that's what I had to get used to.
Well, it's really funny because I had a super easy dog, Titan, my first puppy as an adult. And he was like Maddie, perfect. I mean, he had only one accident that we got him at 4 months and he had one accident in the house and it was because we were traveling and we hadn't let him out. And you know, you get busy and you forget.
Right.
And then we got Socks and it was like having an infant. And when I had children, I mean, my dogs were over 10 when my kids were born. My first was a challenge. And I said, My sister my sister just had a baby, and she said, I don't know how you did it because you were alone. My husband is in the military, so he was gone a lot. And I was like, I had the best teacher. Socks prepared me for that intensity of motherhood, of that, you know, having to be there, plan for them, know that they need you, make, you know, kind of see where you can, cannot come in because the person's coming and you're trying to cross the street. That intensity of caring for a special needs dog is really very much akin to having a child, because it's all consuming. And there are people out there who say, pet parenting is not parenting. And I'm like, well, it depends on the dog you get. And it depends on the cat you get, because sometimes it's even more intense than parenting.
Right. Exactly. It depends.
It really does. And all of this teaches you. So if you had to kind of give us a summary of what your book is, I mean, I know it's a memoir, so it's more than just about the story of these two dogs and how they impacted your life. Tell us about what else we'll learn about you and your story as a pet parent, from somebody who didn't really want a dog to now somebody who's being interviewed on a pet podcast.
Well, I think one thing it's not even though there's two dogs on the cover, it's not just a dog book. It's about coping with life, coping with depression, how you manage to, you know, hope gives you the courage and fortitude to do the hard work you need to do to create how to kind of find that hope and the energy that you get. My parents, I didn't feel loved or liked by them, but the energy derived from loving another being and being loved back. And just because you didn't have it when you were growing up doesn't mean you can't find love and respect as an adult. Just the importance of perseverance, of not giving up to feelings of hopelessness and despair, and I'm very much a one foot in front of the other, and
sounds like it.
You're easier than others. And I think dogs helped me. And, you know, Maddie, she was so sweet and loving. So that, of course, is good for someone who's depressed.
Yes.
And Milo, to be honest, we thought I was an introvert, but I was a depressed extrovert, because then I have Milo. And once he got, you know, after 6 months, I started going to a dog park. I made friends. You know, it was like, so he got me out into the community. I used to be at 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock before I'd go to get my kids. I was feeling really bad. I'd go to the Whole Foods parking lot and watch people. But now I had Milo. I'd go, you know, aww. And you see the same people. And really, I did it. You make friends. You know, your dogs. Milo had this. We actually had them get married. You know, he may believe they were married.
Yes. I saw in your intake form that in your guest form that Milo had a wedding. He was a groom.
That was our dog who died last week. Had the wedding in December, but yeah, that's our second. That was a real wedding. But I'm just saying that the Milo got me out. The book is about just different ways to cope with situations and not to give in. That it can get better. And in my case, Milo was, you know, dogs can help you. Pets can help you.
And you can help the pet, because I think a lot of it is we think about how much and how grateful we are for our pets, because they do fill our lives so much. But I have to raise a glass to you for not returning that dog, because nobody would have judged you for saying, this is too much for me. Nobody would have thought it was crazy to say, like, I can't take this on. And I'm sure you had your inner voice saying, this is too much, but you put one foot in front of the other and you did it. And that takes so much courage and conviction and love. And so I have to praise you for that, because that truly is, it says so much about you as a person.
I guess when you're in it, you don't think. I mean, that day he pulled me in front of the bus after we'd had him just a few days. And I picture going home, putting him in the station and driving. And then I got him on that bed of rags. And like I said, I just resigned myself to 15 years of servitude. I remember just thinking I was just going to be his servant for 15 years.
But it takes a very special person to rise to the occasion. So I want to propose a toast to you for all this that you've shared with us. the inspiration that it is to hear somebody say, after all the turmoil, it was worth it. So cheers to you. Thank you for being my guest.
Okay, thank you.
My pleasure. I also want to propose a toast to my executive producer, Mark Winter. Thank you, Mark. And to our audience for joining us for these wonderful stories about these amazing pet lovers in the world. I love to celebrate these stories and these storytellers and the impact they make, maybe in the industry or maybe in the life of just one super exceptional gifted dog named Milo. So here's to a life covered in pet hair, because there's no better way to live. Cheers. To learn more about Covered in Pet Hair, please visit coveredinpethair.com or petliferadio.com. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.